You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I want to welcome Dr. Nina Ahuja, whom I'm speaking with via mobile phone from Burlington, Ontario, Canada. Welcome, Nina. How are you?
Thank you, Lisa. I'm doing very well. Very happy to be here.
Fabulous. And I'm very happy to have you here 2 days before Christmas. And so are you all set for Christmas?
Well, we're getting there. We're not 100%. I find this time of year is particularly busy wrapping things up with work and trying to get in the Christmas preparations in the meantime, but we'll get there in time.
Oh, good for you. Yes, here in Sweden, it seems like everyone is in, it's impossible to get a parking spot when you go shopping. It's like everyone is, I don't know why people are, and I'm talking about early in the morning. When you don't expect anyone, yes. Oh, so it's a little bit the time of the year everyone seems to get stressed out. And I think this is a wonderful conversation today because you are very much interested in areas of stress and well-being. So it's going to be a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
So if you can just talk about a little bit about your background and the reason why you chose to specialize in ophthalmic surgery.
Yes, absolutely. So you did pronounce it very well, ophthalmic surgery. We're also referred to as being ophthalmologists. An ophthalmologist is a medical doctor who's done additional training 5 years in Canada for specializing in the treatment of eye diseases and eye surgery. The reason I was very interested in it is someone who's worn glasses since I was a child. I've always been fascinated with the eyes. It's the first thing that I notice in people when I meet them. And as I progressed through school, I was always intrigued with sight, how the system works in terms of, you know, perceiving images and how the brain processes. So it was something I was always inclined to. When I finished high school, I went to a university here in Canada that actually offers an optometry program, mm-hmm. which is the healthcare practitioners or professionals who examine the eyes, detect disease, and do treatment of basic conditions. And in that exploration, I realized that I really do enjoy the hands-on, which is what then led me to decide to pursue medicine. I was fortunate enough to get into a medical program. And as I progressed through that program, there was one point where we had to do a project on anything we were interested in. At that time, I was thinking about laser surgery to get rid of my glasses. And in that study, I realized how fascinated I was with the technology that's associated when it comes to eye surgery and treating different conditions. That then led me to doing electives and research. The first time I was in the operating room and saw cataract surgery with my preceptor, right then and there, I knew this is exactly what I wanted to do.
So today, what's the role of AI in eye surgery?
AI in ophthalmology, we're not applying it so much at this point in terms of treatment of conditions or surgical treatments of conditions. We do have teleophthalmology where we're able to assess patients from a distance. In terms of performing procedures at this time, because of the intricate nature of it, the eye is a very small space and the surgery is very, very particular and very delicate. We're not using AI for those specific mechanical aspects. Having said that, there are certainly ways that we're looking at how do we streamline processes? How can we optimize patient interactions so that we can have engagement with patients in a way that allows them to have some guidance and insight into what's happening, and on the other side allows us to make sure that we're able to optimize how we're relaying information. We're at the early phases of all of that, of course. There's a lot of development going on. And also in medical training, there is exploration in how can we use AI to better the education experience and relaying of information to ophthalmology residents, for example, more specifically, but just in medical training in general as well.
Right, right. Now, you are also, you are a private practice owner, and you are also a local and national academic leader. And so what made you interested in academic leadership? And can you share some of the challenges for women in leadership?
Yes. So when I started practice in 2003, I had joined a center. It happened to be where I attended medical school. I had done medical school at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and I did my residency at University of Ottawa in Ottawa, Ontario. When I completed residency, I returned back to Hamilton. And at that time, we did not have a residency training program for ophthalmology at McMaster. In 2005, the division head of the department wanted to resurrect a residency program that had been in place many years ago and was discontinued. He wanted to resurrect it. And because I was a faculty, I was on staff at the time, I became a faculty member and became very highly engaged in academia, in establishing the residency program at McMaster, and in particular, developing the surgical component of the program. What I really loved about it is myself, I struggled when I was in medical school. I really struggled with transitioning from one learning style in my undergraduate degree to a different learning style in medical education. And so I've always had this passion and inclination towards wanting to help learners really have a positive experience. And so this was a really nice opportunity for me to engage in academia in that way. Because I was one of the people who was establishing the program, I was able to take on leadership roles in various phases and in various stages and to varying degrees and in a graduated way through the course of my career, which was really wonderful. It added a completely different dimension to my career, which I to this day is one of my favorite elements and components of what I do. I would say that in terms of challenges for women in leadership, there are a few. I was fortunate in that, at least in the early stages of my leadership career, I had a very supportive network of both men and women. And of course, in medicine, we know that the predominant gender, or sex, I should say, sex identification, sex is what I mean, not gender in terms of how you identify, but regardless, it's more male. And so I was fortunate to have a lot of male mentors around me who were very supportive in my development. As I got more senior, though, it's been interesting where there have been some who've been resistant to having a female leader who they report to. And that, I think a lot of that has come to upbringing, mindset, cultural experience in their upbringing, where it's been a very eye-opening and growth-provoking experience for me, where I've learned how to communicate differently. I've learned how to overcome the challenges by, you know, speaking with other people who can give me insight and guidance as to, you know, what is the issue here? How can we manage it? And how can we optimize the circumstance so we can still work collaboratively, even though technically the person reports to you and, you know, the way the system is set up, sometimes you don't have the authority to manage that the way you would like to, simply because of reporting structures. I would say that that has been something that has come once in a while. I would say majority of the time I've been very fortunate. I've been able to manage circumstances and have everybody on board in a very collaborative spirit, whether you identify as male or female. But there are challenges that we still need to work through. And I feel that in speaking with colleagues and other women leaders, similar instances have come about their path as well, where they need to do more to prove themselves. They need to present themselves differently in how they communicate so that they're taken seriously. Mm. We're getting there. The proportion of women leaders in Canadian ophthalmology at the academic level in terms of chairs is shifting, where it's now more of a parity, which is nice to see. Mm. But we're still not there, certainly in other specialties. But we are getting there. Mm.
So what I'm thinking about women, I mean, you have a family.
Yes.
How does that kind of Does that interfere with your work in your leadership role?
So my situation is unique in that I'm a bonus mom. So I met my two daughters. I say they're my stepdaughters, but they're my daughters to me. I met them when they were 4 and 7, and they are now 19 and 22. They have brought a very unique perspective to my experience. And I don't think it's different than a biological parent. I think that there are unique challenges that come about with being a step parent that sometimes compounds the challenges that you face just raising children. I would say that, and the reason for that is when you have stepchildren, there are a lot of other psychological factors that come into play in their experience that you're managing as a step parent. Whereas if you're a biological parent, I think there are similar challenges, but it's a different twist to it, where when they biologically are yours, they will accept certain things from you differently than if you're a step parent. So that navigating that world takes a lot of emotional intelligence and a lot of co-parenting with your spouse. And my husband and I have worked very, very well together. And thankfully, we've had a very positive experience in this blended family situation. When it comes to the interference with leadership roles, I think that I've always been very mindful of spending time with the children, spending time with my husband, because family to me is priority. My parents also live close by. We're very close as well. I would say that there's a weight that stays with you where, you know, if you're working late hours or you're getting up at early in the morning or you're falling asleep early on the sofa at night because you're exhausted while you're trying to spend time together, those things carry a sense of guilt. I can't deny that. And I think that that experience has been true for me, as it would be for any parent. Having said that, one of the things that I feel has been a very valuable takeaway from it is that both children have seen that you can be very present as a parent and still achieve. And I know I'm saying this from my perspective, but I've had these conversations with our girls to say that, you know, have you felt that I've not been there for you, or that you feel that you wish we had more time together? And I think that in the times that they were with us, because it was a 50-50 arrangement, they were 50% of their time they were with us and then with their mom as well, they always felt that they knew that I would be there for them to deal with whatever challenges they had, and that they recognized that I did take the time at the end of a long day to talk to them for a couple of hours if we needed to, if they were dealing with an issue. So I feel that the guilt aspect is balanced by the value I feel that the role modeling brings to them, also being intentional about spending quality time and being very present all the time, but especially in those moments when the children are struggling. I think that that is a balance that is something that they appreciate. And I think now that they're older, they're recognizing in their own lives that there's nothing wrong with wanting to achieve what they want to achieve, and you can still maintain a sense of balance, as challenging as that can be sometimes.
So you think that your parenting would have also influenced the way you lead?
I do. I feel like the way, you know, there's a saying that how you do one thing is how you do everything. And I feel that at home, where there's been a lot of need for emotional intelligence, given the, you know, complexities of the situation, I bring that into my leadership as well. So that when we have conflicts and when there are discussions and disagreements, that it's really something of an approach that is about, help me understand your perspective. Explain to me what you're thinking. How can we integrate concepts so that, and issues and ideas, that we can pull it all together and bring something cohesive together that is meeting everyone's needs and perspectives. I have to say that my parents were really, they deserve full credit for having developed that emotional intelligence in me since childhood. They raised my brother and I very much in that way. And I can say for myself, anytime I had concerns or issues, they were always helping me explore, like, where is that coming from? Why do you feel that way? How does that impact your experience? And so I'm able to bring that into the leadership as well, just because it's a part of who I am, and it comes into my parenting also.
Mm. Now, you sound very much like an entrepreneur.
I'm discovering that side of myself at this point. Yeah.
Yes, because you sound, because I guess for me, as someone who is very open, you sound very open to ideas, and you know, if there are issues, you're happy to discuss and to try to understand from the other person's perspective. And also because once I found out a little bit about you, you founded Docs in Leadership in 2019. And I was fascinated by it. And I thought, what else is she doing? And so, and I think that is absolutely fantastic. And that's why I'm curious about women in leadership, and also when you kind of connect that with entrepreneurship, which I just feel that that's something you represent in a really good way. So can you share or talk about the reason for the development of Docs in Leadership?
I absolutely, and thank you for those kind words. Docs in Leadership is a passion project of mine that really originated from some of the conflicts that I faced in my leadership journey. So as I mentioned, there were some issues with males having trouble reporting to a female. And there was one in particular who eventually took on a leadership role as I moved on from it. And there were significant issues that arose with administrative staff who, when we were working together, when I was in the role, the person I'm thinking of at the moment was extremely highly productive, highly motivated, just did a wonderful job, was able to be collaborative and all the things you would want to have in an amazing assistant. When leadership changed, however, this very same person went on to have major struggles with stress, anxiety, to the point that she actually ended up having to leave her role and go on to another department. What was particularly frustrating for me is that when these issues were brought forward, when I took on another leadership role where I thought I would have some, you know, authority to be able to help guide and manage this appropriately, there were leaders in the institution who were not well equipped to actually manage this appropriately. And in fact, there were instances where I was encouraged to just let things go and try to manage, where there were definitely objective markers that suggested that things could be managed in a way that could handle this problem well. What I came to realize is that the people were not the leaders who could have led this path of accountability. They weren't doing it because they didn't necessarily want to. They weren't doing it because they didn't see that there were issues and that there was impact happening. But I realized that they'd never really had the education or training in how to manage these types of situations. In medical education, there is no formalized leadership training in any way, shape, or form. There is a competency in a lot of the professional frameworks that the governing bodies in the medical world have. However, there's nothing formalized. And that's coming to the forefront. It's becoming more of an issue where we're recognizing we need to bring this into curriculum. But the way that the evolution of programming is in the academic world, it's not a quick fix. And so for me, because of the frustration that I had, because of the, to be quite frank, anger that I had at some of what was going on, I thought I need to do something about this. And the options were, let's report it or let's do something about it that can actually help the system and not just deal with one issue. And that's where I felt that developing an organization called Docs in Leadership would be a way that I could give back by educating myself, going to the top business schools in our area and getting educated on the best practices in leadership, then combining that with my experience in the many leadership roles that I've held at all levels, then combining that with my frontline experience in healthcare as a provider, as an educator, as a surgeon, as a business owner, and combining all of that to bring forward some initiatives and curriculum and education to people who are in healthcare to help them develop their skills in a way that will hopefully meet that gap until this becomes formal education curriculum in our programming. I think we're years away from that. We're, again, on that path, but this is an initiative that I'm very passionate about, have delivered programs and starting new initiatives coming up in the new year to really bring this and scale this as much as we can, so that we can heal our health system as well as the providers within it. And also, most importantly, in the academic centers, to role model behaviors that people will carry with them through their entire careers, and to say that this is acceptable, this is not acceptable, this is where we have leeway, this is where we not have leeway, this is what we're legally obligated to uphold, this is what we're institutionally wanting to uphold because of the vision of the organization, and so on.
Mm. So when you started the Docs in Leadership in 2019, what was the initial response? Was it automatically welcoming, or did you have kind of people a little bit, well, what kind of initiative is this? We don't need it. And
yeah, that's a very interesting question. It was actually quite well received. I had run a program through the hospital that I'm associated with, and I had declared all conflicts of interest, and I was doing all the things that I need to do to make it clear that this was my own initiative. And I had an initial cohort of about 40 people who went through my program and really felt that it was impactful and beneficial for them. At that time, it was an in-person live program, and people felt that there should be more of this and that this is really necessary and required. When the pandemic happened, the live events had to come to a halt, and so I shifted to online programming. I piloted a program for medical students and residents on how to manage their stress, so that if you can manage your stress, you can be an effective leader. That was very well received as well. It was felt to be a transformative program for medical trainees. And now I've moved on also to have an element of education for faculty as well. One of the common recurring themes is as people come into academic positions like program director, academic chair, there's no formal education on how do you lead in those situations. Again, it's physicians who are very well accomplished, who are doing well academically in terms of their teaching roles, research expertise, and contributions, but they've never really been leaders with formal training. But because we're physicians in an academic center that is healthcare-based, the physicians become the leaders. So that now I'm really looking to fill the gap of leadership education for people who are going along academic leadership roles in conjunction with people who are leaders in clinical hospitals as well. So those are the things that are coming forward. And I have discussions with people all the time where, oh, I'm taking on this new chair role, I'd like to take your programming. So it is something that's being very well received. The challenge in academic centers, however, is that there's no funding. So that's where I'm now launching an online community to hopefully at least get something out there for people that's more affordable.
Challenges are common among medical students during the pandemic?
So the stresses that were unique to the trainees during the pandemic, there were a few of them. One is that during the pandemic, of course, early on especially, we didn't know what was going to happen with it as a disease entity itself. And so the residents who were on the front line were really in the heat of it, in the sense that there was a safety risk. That was stressful for all of us, but especially for the residents who were the ones seeing and assessing patients initially before they reported back to us as staff. And then if we needed to support and come in, then of course we would be involved as well. But they were really at the front line of it. Another thing was is the timing of the pandemic was in the spring. As you know, the closures and the alarm bells went off in March. And that is a time of that followed a lot of the residency interviews, and it was approaching exams for a lot of people. So the final certification exams for the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Canada, for example, for specialty. That was a very critical period where people didn't know, are exams going to happen? Are they not going to happen? Graduates who were looking for jobs, that's often the time for interviews and transitions and trying to look for opportunities. That was impactful as well. And then, of course, those are some of the logistics things from, your future planning. But then a lot of the students experienced disrupted rotations where they did not have the education experience that you would typically have going through one rotation on the clinic and then having your in-person teaching, your didactic sessions versus your sessions that are happening to go through Q&A and whatnot. There was a lot of disruption there. And then, of course, if patients were not doing very well, now ophthalmology was a little bit different, but in those specialties like internal medicine, ICU, where you were seeing people dying, then of course there was the whole emotional burden and toll, which was also coming about, in addition to things like, you know, the moral dilemmas that come with it and the burnout that comes with it and all of that. In person, when things transitioned to online, I felt that the students were getting used to the virtual platform. And the biggest thing I would say that they appreciated is being connected with each other, where it may not have been as opportune to do so in person. This was an opportunity for students from across the country to really be able to engage with each other and talk about experiences and be guided along situations as these discussions were facilitated by me. I think that is an opportunity that was also revealed to us, that there is a forum by which we can pull people together across the country, across the world, to really be able to share experiences, insights, knowledge, stresses, and to realize that we all really are united. And like you said, a lot of the stresses are common. There are some unique ones within medicine, given the fact that you're dealing with the disease entity, you're dealing with the patients, and your, you know, medical education was disrupted, and you know there were the uncertainties associated with that. But there's real value in the shared experience of whatever it is that you're going through in situations like that.
How did you deal with it?
I actually wrote a book. So for me, we had a period in Ontario, our province of Ontario, where we were mandated to be closed clinically, and it ended up being a 3-month period. Because at that time I held a leadership role at the national level, I was seeing all the stresses that were happening for medical students. And for me, one of my outlets is writing. At that time, I was also really reminded of all the stresses that I went through and felt in my medical school experience, in the transitions in learning styles, as I mentioned, where I ended up spiraling into self-doubt and, you know, had a lot of uncertainty about my future direction. And then in residency as well, where I was diagnosed with a rheumatoid arthritis, which is a chronic medical condition, which as a microsurgeon was extremely frightening, with a lot of uncertainty when it came about for me, because it was when it hit me, it was impacting my hands and my feet, and it was just not a good situation. So I was brought back to that time, and I thought, you know, with the residents going and medical students going through their stresses now, and nursing students and all trainees in healthcare, I felt that this was a time for me to tell my story, to basically say that, you know, this is how my experience went. These are lessons that I've learned from that time and through my career. Now looking back, it's sort of the advice that I wish I would have had at that time. And so I wrote my book. And because writing for me is very therapeutic and cathartic in my own way, that was something that I was able to channel my stresses through, and then try to, you know, do sessions with my fellow academic leaders from across the country to be able to deliver sessions and things to our community to help keep everyone connected.
And of course, the title to the book is Stress in Medicine, Lessons Learned Through My Years as a Surgeon, From Med School to Residency and Beyond. So can you just share a little bit about your experiences of stress and ways that you managed and manage stressful situations today?
Absolutely. The stresses that I had gone through were very deep for me in different ways. So as I mentioned, in medical school, I struggled. I was always top of my class. I think all of us as high achievers and who are in professions, we all do well. And so for me to go from being top of my class in my academic career into medical school, where I felt like I hit rock bottom, that was very challenging. And the irony of it is, my supervisors were all saying I was doing very well. My tests and evaluations that we had in the problem-based learning style were all doing very well. But because I was caught up in that perfectionistic tendency of, I have to know everything about every case and I need to really, you know, I'm going to kill somebody if I don't. And I got so wrapped up in that fear of hurting someone and that idea of perfectionism that I spiraled into self-doubt. And I truly hit imposter syndrome at the height of it when I was accepted into ophthalmology, which there were 13 spots across the country. So here I was spiraling in self-doubt and I got into one of the most competitive programs in the country. So my dealing with those stresses was really primarily at that time seeking support. My parents were a huge source of support at that time. I had some wonderful mentors in my education in both medical school and residency who were really able to help guide me and help me see that, you know, you are learning what you need to learn. The biggest challenge I found, though, was adopting that belief into my own mindset. And honestly, it didn't really happen. I didn't realize how much I was carrying with me of that entire experience until I wrote my book. And I realized I still have some of those elements with me. And then as I reflected, I put together my framework, which is the ADMIT framework, recognizing that these sources of stress and these sources of insecurities were really coming from one of five main sources of stress, which is A stands for adapting to new ways. I was having trouble adapting my mindset to the fact that if I'm doing well, I can believe that I know my stuff. D is doing the work where, you know, you're so overwhelmed with things and there are so many things to do that when I was accomplishing things, I really needed to be able to recognize that, yes, I do know what I'm doing and I am getting the work done. M stands for measuring success. So be really looking at, you know, I'm very hard on myself so that if I don't get the 10 things done on the list, if I get 7 done, I was measuring my success as being I didn't get the 10 done. And so recognizing, you know, how do we redefine measuring success, which leads to the I, introspection. So what am I doing that I need to shift my mindset on so that I can then go to T, which is transform, so I can transform my mindset and then really be able to navigate the stresses constructively. So that the ADMIT framework, A, as ADMIT, it encourages you to admit that you're struggling, but it really provides a problem-solving framework so that you can address stress and explore stress in a very structured way. That's how I manage stresses to this day now that I had discovered this since writing the book. And the reason I find that very helpful is as a concrete thinker, as many of us are in academia, I find that having that structure helps keep things organized for me. And it allows for a very thoughtful reflection on the various components of what I may be struggling with. And then I can do a deep dive into what area I need to then create a game plan and go through the second part of that framework, which is the 3 R's, where you reflect on the circumstance, you reframe it into something that is constructive and positive, and then you respond with a growth mindset, recognizing you won't and you don't have to get everything right the first time and that it'll evolve as you discover more about what you're doing next. The good things, and yet it's our Achilles heel as high achievers, is that belief, and I shouldn't say it's a good belief, actually, I take that back, but it's that belief that failure is not an option, right? And I think that if we take that literally, we are setting ourselves up for a very stressful experience in this world. Whereas if we're saying that failure is an option, and it's okay to fail because failure isn't really failure. It's an opportunity to learn something new or an opportunity to pivot, right? So one of the things that I've learned over the course of my career and personally as well is that if something doesn't turn out the way we had hoped or the way we had planned or the way we expected it to, it's often, actually, I would say in my own experience, pretty much every time, given me an opportunity to really reflect and pivot into something that ended up being even better. And so to have that idea that failure is not an option, I think while we're, it's almost like part of who we are as high achievers, I think we need to release that and just view everything as its own experience. And as so long as we're doing our best and we're trying to be mindful and diligent and thoughtful and kind about what we do, just to expect that these boulders that come along our way are going to kind of bump us into the right path, into the direction that we're supposed to be on, and to contribute the way we're intended to contribute.
Today, you are on a mission to empower medical trainees, physicians, and fellow healthcare professionals with strategies for excellence without burnout. So can you share some strategies on how to prevent burnout, but also how to recognize burnout before it happens?
Yes. So one of the key things that I think is essential in preventing burnout is increasing our self-awareness. We are so busy and so caught up in all the to-dos that we have to do, to all the responsibilities that we have to uphold, to all the different directions that we're being pulled in, that it's often very difficult to just take a moment to sit and reflect on how you're feeling and what you're experiencing in any given moment. The self-awareness piece is something that I found to be extremely valuable in my own experience, which is why I can say this with true confidence, where when I was at my rock bottom in medical school and my parents were really helping me discover where that was coming from, and then my mentors were helping me work through those issues, I came to realize that being aware of what we're doing and how it's impacting us is extremely important. And the reason for that is because that impacts how we then interact with the world. So for example, if we're all, you know, have a clean, clear window that we're looking at the world through and we're receiving the world through, if something has put a crack in that window, if we don't recognize that that crack is there because it's a micro crack or micro fracture, whatever you want to, however you want to think of it, that impacts our view. And the more of those that we have that go unrecognized, the more our view is impacted without us realizing it. So that a situation that may have been a minor disagreement suddenly becomes a major argument because you're viewing that minor disagreement through all of these cracks of things that you haven't identified as being things that are impacting you. And so building on, you know, this thought pattern of failure is not an option. I've always been a high achiever. What's happening? I'm now not doing as well as I used to. I'm not able to be there for my family. I'm not able to be there for my loved ones. I can't get that project done. I can't get that paper written. All of those things are impacted by how we view ourselves and how we view the world. And so to me, being able to recognize these experiences within ourselves become really important to managing burnout so that we can catch ourselves before we hit that level of experience where everything we're viewing is overwhelming because there's just so much to look through that we haven't even recognized we're needing to look through that. One of the ways that I feel that we can recognize we're approaching that point is noticing your stress behaviors increasing in frequency and new behaviors that are very unusual. What do I mean by that? So knowing that your stress behaviors are increasing in frequency. So for example, I tend to sleep a lot when I'm tired. So or I'm stressed. So if I'm sleeping more than I'm actually getting things done, I know that that's a stress response. I need to stop and reflect on where I'm at. If some people who overeat, you may be eating more because of comfort, you're just noticing you're wanting to eat all the time. So these behaviors get augmented. On the other side, for me, when I know that I'm approaching what I call the tipping point, which is that point where your stress is so high that it's beyond that peak productivity stress level, but you're at risk of tipping into that downward spiral of burnout and all the things that come with that, I start to swear a lot. So all of a sudden, like everything I say, I'm frustrated. It's like swear left, right, center. And then that's when I'm like, okay, Nina, you need to stop. Pull back.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And so these are behaviors that it's like, why am I suddenly swearing? And I'm not a swearer, swearing type of person in general. So there are certain things that you come to recognize are signs for you to hitting that or approaching that tipping point. And again, unless you're aware of what those are, it's very easy to overlook it and then just, you know, tip over and then slide into that doom.
Yes. And look, and this is, of course, so important for us. I think you just explained this. You provided a wonderful example. And I think this is something that we definitely need to consider and reflect on, that how to recognize our own self when we are getting, before we get to that burnout stage or we're tipping over, but we recognize, okay, things are not working. There's something not going, something is not right. I probably should, I say to people, I said, if when you see I'm getting angry, I start swearing in Finnish. You see, Finnish and Swedish are two different languages, and Swedish, it's really doesn't sound really horrible swear words, but in Finnish, it's very, very, it's very interesting. But I'm not going to repeat them. Now, you're launching an online community in the new year for medical trainees and healthcare professionals in practice. So what motivated you to do this? Is this in connection with Docs Online or Docs, the leadership?
Yes. So it is a Docs and Leadership initiative. It's called the Mindful Med Community. And yes, and so the idea of that was to be able to bring forward this education on leadership development, emotional intelligence, maintaining well-being in a way that is more accessible to people, and to actually bring people together in community, because there's such value in community, as I was mentioning earlier. The idea is that so the community is open to all, as you mentioned, and within that, there will be monthly sessions that are live delivery of curriculum with an opportunity for Q&A and different opportunities to engage in between. So certain challenges. So for example, we're going to have a mindfulness week. Every day they'll be prompted to do a mindfulness exercise. And then another one will be about leadership. So let's, you know, a week of observation. So observe what's working in people and what's not working in people in the sphere that you're in. And then again, on emotional intelligence, so that there'll be this ongoing engagement of little short bursts of, you know, thought-provoking activity or challenge or discussion to bring these ideas to the forefront in an affordable way. The reason for that is a lot of the programs that I do are costly, and either academic centers or institutions don't have the funding for it. Students certainly don't have the funding for it. Healthcare professionals in practice, more so, however, it's something that I really feel passionate about. And so I want to bring it, you know, broadly as I can, in a way that offers people support and guidance and education right from the trainee level through to taking on these leadership positions, where then there are concentrated programs that if people want to take it beyond the community, well, then you can register for it. Say you're, you know, taking on a chair position at an academic center. Well, then, you know, you can have this program and ongoing support for a year, for example, if you want to join the mastermind group or however you choose to do it. I'm launching it on January 9th. I'm doing an open webinar, which will be online as a Zoom meeting, which is maintaining a healthy mindset in high stakes situations, simply because this time of year for trainees and for people who are moving into different roles, it's a high stress period. So medical students are doing interviews in medical schools. Residents are doing sorry, undergrad are doing interviews for medical schools. Medical students are doing interviews for residency programs, or trying to get new jobs and doing interviews for that. Royal College exams and certification exams are coming up. And then there are transitions to new roles coming in within months after that for academics. So it's just it's a session to set the mindset and intention for the year. It's open to everyone. And then that's where, if people are interested, they can join into the community for deep dive work on it. And if not, then at least it's hopefully going to give some value to people who participate.
What a wonderful initiative.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it. It's a culmination of all of the learning that I've had in this space as a clinician, as a leader, provider, educator, but then even having gone through delivering programming in this new entrepreneurial space that you mentioned. So having brought those experiences together and also learning how to align it to who I am. So I've tried different things in different ways, and some have felt right and some haven't felt right. And it's those boulders and pivots that I was talking about that have really brought me to this initiative, which I feel offers what I'm hoping to in a way that aligns with my own personal mission and values as well.
So what is next for you?
I think for me, I'm really excited about diving deep into this community and just delivering education and helping people feel empowered in the space. That's from a professional standpoint. Personally, I'm really looking forward to being able to spend time with my family and my friends and do a little bit more traveling and opening up a little bit more of an exploratory phase in my life, in the sense that personally I've done some really exciting things, and my husband and I have raised these beautiful daughters together, and there's been so much growth in that professionally in my evolution through being a healthcare provider and private practice owner and educator and leader. That's been a wonderful exploration. And so now I'm really looking at how that all comes together in the spirit of giving back, and then what joys that brings for me personally and professionally through, you know, travels and meeting people, speaking to people, and hopefully delivering this message more broadly.
And so one of my final questions is, what is your perspective on AI and the impact of digital tools on students' mental health and well-being?
AI is fascinating to me. I've actually explored it quite a bit and played with it myself. I think that there's certainly value in AI when it comes to helping students augment their learning and also just gaining exposure to how this can contribute to delivery of healthcare, which is up and coming, as we chatted about earlier. In terms of mental health, though, I have concerns with it, in that I feel that AI is, as I said, it's incredible in terms of the knowledge it's able to collate from the sources that are available out there. There are opportunities, of course, for students and anyone really to say, I'm having this issue, how would you help me deal with it? But what I feel is a real gap, which is understandable because it's a machine, AI is machine, as we know, is that human element, where the human connection piece is so important in supporting one another and helping one another and guiding one another from that empathy perspective, where I can feel, you know, or understand how you must be feeling and feel that with you. I can be in that space with you. I can observe your nonverbal cues, which AI cannot do, to see, you know, your words are saying one thing, your actions are saying another thing, which is it? Let's work it out together. So while I feel that there's value in terms of the theoretical aspects of mental health and well-being, the human aspect, I think, is something that can never be replaced. And so for those medical trainees and healthcare professionals and anybody really who's seeking support for their mental health using AI, I would just encourage them to absolutely not eliminate that element of community, human connection, and, you know, social well-being that is so important in maintaining our mental health.
Is there anything that comes to your mind that I haven't mentioned that you think, she didn't ask me that? Or is there something in your mind that you think is of special importance to mention?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to chat with you. I really am grateful for that. I think the biggest thing that I would say is, as we're transitioning into a new year, it's an opportunity to really take time to reflect now and have that as a fresh start. And I feel like I hesitate to say that because I don't really encourage us to mark January 1st as a fresh start as a new year, but we happen to be there. and we're used to that frame of mind, right? And so I would say that take this time to reflect. We are approaching a new year, which is a turnover of sorts, and to just really focus on the idea of progress over perfection. I think that is something that we need to carry with us always. And if we haven't been good at that until now, that should be something that we truly carry into the new year in all that we do, whether it's personal or professional, and just being kind to ourselves. I think those are some key points that I would encourage people to take away as well.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.